the people I admire most, they just enjoyed their days at home and at work. And the financial, the success, I just believe if you get talented people in a room with really long time horizons, like all that will take care of itself.
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. This podcast is a venue for me to follow my curiosity through conversations with leading thinkers and builders. My guest today is Adam Ryan. Adam is the co-founder and CEO of Workweek, a collective of industry expert creators aiming to create business content their audiences actually enjoy. Adam's also a creator himself. We talk about all things Workweek and the B2B creator economy. Please enjoy. There's, in hindsight, this clear through line within your career, whether or not you knew it at the time, that was culminating in what you're doing at Workweek, combining content with B2B. Two questions. One is, what was the larger trend or shift you saw in the market that Workweek was born out of? And then two was, is why was right now the right time for this?
So in November, December of 20, I started spending a ton of time studying the creator space. And what that looked like, the possibilities, obviously, of what was coming to it. One thing that I believed was true was that, this trend of, like, I call it, you know, creators, this confusing term. I like to say that the real trend line we bet on was individuals over institutions. And, that's been happening for decades. The Jordan brand is a perfect example of that. And the growth of the Jordan brand over the last two decades, like, shows that people are starting to do that more and more. Obviously the Kylies of the world hitting that sort of success. And, you know, influencers, celebrities launching their own brand is not new. It's actually happened for decades and decades, going back to like the 50s. But the success and scale that they've been able to have is new. When looking at that, I think we believed that people started to trust, you know, their favorite Instagram influencer on the makeup they chose or the sports energy drink that they bought. But the reality is the problem that's always existed in B2B, even when we're just focusing on ads, is the best B2B marketers just treat their buyers like humans. They like a meme. They like the joke. You don't have to be so serious. And, you know, at Spiceworks, we had our mascot be like an orange dinosaur because, like, IT pros normally like orange dinosaurs more than they like suits and ties. And that was something that's really, like, resonated with me for a long time. And when thinking about decision making, I think we also saw this trend that there was just such dry content in B2B. And there's a tweet that I'll forever remember, which was by Trung, and he tweeted a meme about Kesha's song Timber, and it was about timber prices. And it was, like, so memorable and so culturally relevant, but also, like, informative. And I was like, this is the future of how people want to learn things. Mm-hmm. And you can have fun and make jokes while still, like, being credible. And I do think that's a new trend that's happening. I think 20 years ago, if you, like, made jokes or were more informal, people didn't take you as credible as you are. And we saw that with clothing and apparel. V-necks and sneakers started to come in, and now I think you're seeing that with content. And those two kind of trends was what we wanted to kind of capture.
You explained why B2B, and obviously given your background, it makes sense why you would start there. But I'm curious if you still see a similar opportunity in B2C, and if so, did you consider starting there instead?
Do I think there's still opportunity? Absolutely. In consumer, I think the thing that I realized, and obviously this is not everyone doing this today, so I don't want to take it that way, but there's a big difference of using your distribution as the fire versus the fuel. And I think a lot of consumer influencers are leaning into their distribution as the cause for success instead of really focusing on a product that is differentiated, that has a brand, that has a story, that stands on its own. I think we've seen best practices of that not being attached to the name, like Prime with Logan. Where the more attached it is, it's kind of these highs and lows of, like, are they doing well? Then the business does well. And that's not sustainable. I mean, I think it's a great way for a creator to make a living, but for an investment perspective or for a long-term product, I think, like, really focusing on solving a true problem for the buyer. And in B2B, you're forced to do that, which made us really excited. You can't just, like, push something out and expect people to buy it and stay in it. And the enterprise value. I mean, something I think I like to say work week is a culmination of the scars of my past. But one of the things we realized was like, it's really just as hard to sell a $300 subscription for content as we did at the Hustle or event ticket as it is to sell other B2B SaaS products. It's not that different from a marketing perspective, from a stress perspective, but the enterprise value you can create is drastically different. And so there's also a decision of like what can be worth our time and maximize the value there.
Even though on the surface, this seems distribution led, you mentioned that really you want to focus on the product. When does the focus on the product come in? Does it start all the way back when you're evaluating creators to bring in? Or are you bringing in creators that you think can communicate with the audience and then you're going to develop products around them?
It's from the first conversation. So like with franchise, the question I ask that allows me to kind of weed out if someone is a knowledge expert or not pretty quickly is, tell me an inevitable truth of your industry or your business that others may not know. And, you know, when I asked the Wolf that for the Wolf of Franchises, he was like, no one has a clue, but like the whole buying process is completely opaque. It's like a total scam. It's like they're ripping buyers off. No one's sharing real insights. And like, it's everyone's grabbing from each other. And the buying process is like completely outdated. And if you search that, you can't find anything online that like deeply talks about how kind of like the old school tactics of franchise buying is like nasty. You see a lot of bad reviews of brokers and things like that, but you don't see that. And so it provided immediate insights of like, well, this is a problem. And most of these folks are coming in saying like, I have a mission. He wanted to make franchising transparent. And when you attach like a mission to a problem, you can start to build a content strategy around that. You can start to create a community and membership around that that has those same ideals. And then ultimately, you can build with that audience to build a product that they really want.
You've been fortunate with the Wolf and I imagine others in your stable of creators where you found people who are experts, creators, and entrepreneurs or operators. But those are hard to come by. And I'm curious, is it harder to turn experts into creators or creators into entrepreneurs and operators?
The Wolf would tell you he struggled a lot. I mean, so we announced our partnership in February of 22. He actually started full time in September, October with us. We made him do, we begged him, we were like, you have to get better at this. We begged him to do a thread every day in November of 21. And he talks about that month as like a breaking point of like, I don't know if this is what I want to do. And the reality is we believe if you have industry insights, you can become a great creator. You can teach someone copywriting, you can study trends. And the Wolf did an amazing job of that early on. He put all his heart and soul into it being like, okay, I'm committed to this. And like, I can do this. And when you have those insights and you start to learn those, it's much easier. I think it's much, much harder to say, hi, hey, go replicate the insights of someone who's been doing this for 10 or 15 or 20 years. So, you know, for us, I call it the knowledge expert paradox. The people that are successful in an industry or a business typically have the best insights to share. But the people who are successful in industry or business are typically the ones who would never share it because of time, resources, financial reasons. Like if you're a physician and you make $350,000 a year owning your own practice, why would you care about writing a newsletter? And what we wanted to do was identify opportunities to solve for that paradox. And it's a full list of things that it requires. But, you know, the Wolf is a good example of turning someone that I was his A subscriber. He had sent one newsletter when I reached out to him. And I thought it was great, by the way. You know, he worked really hard. And now we have a whole team dedicated to helping our creators be more successful at their content strategy.
You alluded to a few answers to the question I'm about to ask, but with the barriers to entry for content creation, as well as just sustaining creation and getting your own distribution, with all of that being drastically lowered over the last decade or two, why would a creator consider working with Workweek instead of staying independent?
There's not a simple answer to that because every creator has their own motivations. What we're looking to do, I won't work with anyone that I don't think we can build at least a $10 million business with, around media specifically. And so, you know, we have our kind of target points. And if someone, you know, I ask them very much up front of like, hey, what's your end goal? And someone will say, I kind of like this thing. I kind of like the attention, you know, the ego, but like, I don't love it. Like, I kind of don't want to do it. Or, hey, I don't really ever want to write. I just want to do a podcast. Well, like, there's like choices that they can make. And that's, you know, we are becoming more and more flexible based on passions and strengths. But for us, we like really believed in a certain type of playbook, but also a certain type of mentality. And like our favorite people to work with was like one of our creators who writes a HR newsletter. I Hate It Here. What she told us, she had never created any content before, ever. And she was like, look, HR people are so lonely. We all hate our jobs because like no one helps or supports us. I want to write a book one day. And I was like, when I asked her, like, what's your goals? And she's like, I want to write a book one day. I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like, tell me about it. And she now has the largest HR newsletter in the country by any trade publication. It's 130,000 subscribers and only 8 months old, 57% unique open rate, amazing community. She's just killing it. And for us like that, we can coach on certain best practices. We can give certain formats, but we need that mentality. And when we started to find that, it's kind of like finding an athlete that's like, I'm willing to do whatever it takes to be successful. But like, we all know there's a difference of like being coached by a JV high school team and then being coached at a pro level and the upskill needed and then the teammates around you. And, you know, what the goal, one of the learnings that we had that I took away from The Hustle was like, we did one course one time and we made like over $100,000. And I was like, wow, this could be like a sustainable new source of revenue. And then I like looked into it and I was like, to build an education team, like this makes no sense. Like we're going to saturate the audience. We're going to resell this. Like it just like doesn't make sense to invest in this like going forward as like a big play. And then when going to work week, it was like, hey, we can have an events team. We can have an education team. We can have a marketing team and they can be world-class at what they do because they can sell across, they can work across 15 different brands. And so, and then you find synergies and efficiencies within that to make those businesses more successful. And, you know, that's what we think we're unlocking is like, this is not a question of, hey, can we like ghostwrite for you or sell your ads? This is a question of like, hey, do you want to build a $10 million business and then become the industry expert and become the biggest voice? And the reality is like, you need to surround yourself with the people that can unlock that. And we think there was a gap in the market that a lot of people are creating the barrier to create interest in content creation, like Substack and Beehive. And I'm forever grateful for those businesses because we could not be successful without that interest happening. Mm-hmm. There's more physicians wanting to become content creators today, which is like a trend that we appreciate. But the reality is like building a business that's largely successful and growing very quickly and produces cash flow and like actually allows your reputation to increase does not just happen like out of your living room by yourself. And there's exceptions to the rules. There's amazing people that have been able to do it. And like Packy and Mario Gabriel and others. And I think if you ask them, they're like, I work my ass off. I work all the time. This is like my whole life. And I got a little lucky with timing. I was like this first person doing this and that. And now like, I think if you wanted to start from scratch and you wanted to say, hey, I want to make $400,000 by year three, how do I do it? The likelihood's very, very low. And you're probably going to end up spending a lot of time doing things that you actually aren't skilled to do. And some people still want to take that journey. And I commend and recommend them for that. But for the people that we're working with, we're aligned on that partnership that like we can build something really successfully together in a way that potentially both of us could not have done on our own.
It doesn't seem like there's a singular persona that Workweek is looking for. It sounds like you're willing to somewhat, at least on the edges, tailor the business you're going to build to the creator you're bringing in. But I imagine there are still a handful of attributes or traits that you're looking for consistently, mentality being one of those that you just mentioned. What are the other ones?
Yeah. I mean, one, we've not been, you know, we've had people not be successful with us. And I mostly blame Workweek for that. About 1 in 7 have not made it 12 months. And that's for a wide variety of reasons. So I don't think we've like figured it out how to be perfect at this in any capacity. But the thing that we really judge the success on is like very simple framework. It's capacity, which is like how much can you do? And that goes into play. Like, you know, one of our sales creators is a VP of sales at like a Series B startup. He's got a super high pressure job. Our HR creator is also the chief people officer at Workweek. She hired 21 people in Q1, like she's pretty busy. So capacity has something to do with, of course, your other priorities that you may have at that time, but also there are people that are just absolutely prolific. The Wolf is prolific at doing threads. Daniel Murray is prolific at being on a podcast. Gabrielle, one of our creators, is prolific at TikTok. Like everyone has different strengths, and capacity is a good measure of that. Consistency is the next one. It takes work day in and day out. And that's from our team. That's from our ad sales team every day, making sure we're building a pipeline. That's for the marketing team, making sure we're always changing out creatives. That's for our operations team, always trying to be more efficient with how we can save people time. But also for the creators to show up every day and be like, this is like what I have to thrive at right now. I like to explain to people is like, I expect you to need to take like hard breaks because you're on stage. If you have that framework of like, hey, if more like a Broadway show, like, hey, I'm going on stage right now. Like I'm going to get in Twitter. I'm going to do this. I'm going to go on this podcast, and you view it as like being on stage. Make sure you recognize when you walk off stage and like breathe, relax, practice, do what you need to do. And that consistency, some people really struggle with. We're trying to build more and more in, but it definitely is something that we bet for. And then the last one is ability. It's just the kind of truth that some people are naturally born to be amazing storytellers. Mm-hmm. Some people are naturally born to like be able to convince people that this is the right way to go about building a team or buying a franchise. And that storytelling ability with those insights, we can coach that, but there's definitely a natural skill set there. And over time, it's also about improving that. And the Wolf is like such a good example, but there's many others. Nicole Kasperson, there's a lot that they just continue to improve their abilities as a creator, on a podcast, hosting events, writing newsletters, deep dives, social, that we look for.
Which of those skills or characteristics do you think, and I'm generalizing here, creators today most underappreciate or under cultivate? The one that would be the reason for their success, but they haven't cultivated as much as they should.
I think consistency is so difficult because you can have the capacity and the ability, and sometimes life just gets in the way. We will have 3 of our 14 creators this year take maternity or paternity leave. It is very difficult to be consistent when you're in that situation.
Right.
And so sometimes this has nothing to do with mindset. Sometimes it's just life. And I think the creators that we've had a lot of success and fun with recognize that, like, yes, I have to want to show up every day, but also like it's impossible for me to do that. And if I'm being realistic, and so what we had to do was, how do we solve for that? How do we make people where they can thrive instead of worrying about surviving? And that's one of our values of the business. And that's really what, if we do that correctly, that's what it helps solve for, is consistency. And I think a lot of creators going on their own either sacrifice a lot of their life to be consistent, or they actually aren't.
As I was looking through the list of your creators, outside of a newsletter, I didn't notice a consistent medium or platform that all of them were using. And again, this goes to the Yep. a point made earlier, which is you're doing somewhat of tailoring to the unique creator. But I did notably notice that, and maybe the links on your website were just missing. A lot of them weren't doing video. Right. I think especially short form video, and partially makes sense coming from your background of newsletters. But I'm wondering if that was first, if this is correct, and second, if this was an intentional decision, and if you have plans to focus more on video in the future.
Incredibly intentional. Two main drivers for us. One, cost. It's just more expensive to do video. And video is getting cheaper, of course, we know. But actually, to do long-form storytelling video, to do it right, is scripted, is like expensive. We just put out our first one. We did it on YouTube with The Wolf. It's really great. We love it. I do think YouTube is a platform that we have to invest more into, but it is an investment. I don't see it as ROI positive for a very long time. Monetization on video is very similar to podcasts. It's very barbelled. The 99% of people basically make no money. And then once you hit it big, you can make an insane amount of money. And that path across the bell, the barbell is expensive and hard. And so, you know, as a startup, we chose not to do that at first. There were creators that we worked with that had like a knack for video. And, you know, and we're not going to discourage that at all, but really putting that through. And then the other one, besides the cost and investment, because that will go away one day as we can kind of build and invest in that. The other one, though, is like thinking about the entry points of the funnels of the audience and the sequencing that you want to have there. And I absolutely believe video can be a moat in B2B. It's like one of those untapped natures, and I'm excited to lead the effort to fix that. But it is significantly easier to drive newsletter subscribers through Twitter and LinkedIn because it's text first. And so you're already capturing an audience that likes to read, that they already have this intention of like, I want to learn more. Where video, it's not the same. The conversion rate, I think, is slightly less. It's just harder. It's a different path. And for us, data is a massive piece of our business as we scale and grow. We think that's really what like the WorkWeek ecosystem, as we look to you know, go further, knowing who our audience is, what they want, their problems that they have, and then solving those is what we're all about. And if you're dependent on platforms that don't really give you that insider or zero party, first party data, and they don't really convert well to newsletters, it makes it a tough decision to go there. And that's kind of what we've been battling. We are going into more live events. So we announced last week our marketing festival in October called Marketing Land. And it's going to be an awesome day-long event for any marketers. And as we go into that, more and more live video will be a huge aspect of helping, obviously, as a content marketing play to bring awareness to those events. And so it's something we'll continue to get into, but those are kind of the two reasons why we avoided it at first.
There's so many different platforms and mediums that creators can leverage. And similarly, there's so many different ways to monetize your audience, from sponsored newsletters to job boards to courses to communities. Is there a optimal mix and sequence of monetization that you found? Understanding that kind of the place you're trying to get to is SaaS, ultimately B2B SaaS. But in the meantime, what is the right mix and sequencing of those other monetization strategies?
There's a simple answer, which is the scale that we use internally, this graph called attention to intention, and starts with newsletters, and then starts with socials, and then newsletters, then podcast, then events, then community, then education, and then products and services. And as you build your reputation, as you go from attention to intention, that's kind of like an ideal path. That's what I kind of more broadly would present on. The reality is that every industry is very different. If you have a podcast in franchising, your reputation is, and you're consistent on it for 6 months, people are like, oh shit, this guy's the go-to guy in franchising. If you have a podcast in marketing, like, most people don't care. Right. So we have to individualize our sequencing for every industry we work with. It's a challenge of the business for sure. It's something that we've gotten better and better at. It's also why you've seen us expand, where now we work with, you know, six different people in marketing. We work with multiple in healthcare. And the idea there is like, it allows us to replicate more and more playbooks and sequences that match those audiences' needs, and makes the most efficient effort to grow those reputations and increase intention. And so the order of those sometimes are mismatched, but that's kind of the scale of how we would judge that.
How are you identifying niches to go after? One lens is just kind of untapped or underdeveloped markets, but obviously the bigger markets are the ones that are already somewhat saturated, albeit maybe fragmented. Are you trying to find ones that are undertapped, or are you thinking about the longer game and trying to kind of own a portion of these larger, more saturated markets? I imagine it's a mix.
It's a mix. And we've gotten a lot better at it, of understanding where it's at. I kind of like to look at kind of a three component strategy of right now, and this literally evolves probably every 6 months based on like kind of where the business is as we grow, but purchasing power. So a lot of people, my mom's a nurse, my whole family's nurses, they're like, why did you not do something for nurses? Why did you do for doctors? And I was like, well, I know there's 7x the amount of nurses than there are doctors, but they have probably 20x purchasing power. So right. There's that equation. Addressable market is something that we do look at, how many people are there and what's the kind of combination of that as well, which goes into purchasing power. And then definitely something that we've like learned and picked up on is like, and this can kind of go either way, but just understanding what is the lay of the land with media. Like the largest franchise media business probably does like 6 to 8 million a year. Where the very small, the largest marketing brand, you could argue there's like $1 billion basically companies that do that. And what we've learned there is like, it's the ease to get into it. It was a bear to monetize franchising at first. We had to think about it totally differently. It's still a uphill battle for sure from like an ads perspective, monetization. And compared to like marketing and HR, like they can take off from day one. And so that's a kind of goes back to the individualization. And then lastly is definitely like as a whole, how can we really think about these categories as we grow? So like healthcare is a good example, but Blake writes hospitality. He's really writing for like healthcare strategists, hospital administrators, really underserved audience with like modern day content. But Healthcare Huddle writes for providers. Jared's an MD. He writes for physicians. There's enough overlap there that we like that. They do events together. But there's more spaces in healthcare that we think we can get into that continue that overlap, similar in marketing, how we'd found that. And so, industry kind of overlap and segment opportunities, purchasing power, and then kind of like what will the monetization strategy be? And if it's heavy, if it's proven in a media industry, then we know we could probably sell ads from day one and start to make that great. If it struggles, it doesn't mean. I met with someone yesterday who is a knowledge, like 100% a knowledge expert in foundation repair. Massive industry, houses are getting older. He knows more about it than like basically anyone in the country. Every consumer is affected by it. There's no ads in that space. It doesn't mean I don't want to get into it, but it means like, hey, we probably need to focus like, are there conferences? Are there other, certifications? Like what is the monetization play before we get to SaaS? And the reason for that membership and those education things is to us, that's like intention validation. Like, hey, this audience really is starting to show signs of success, that they really trust and believe in this brand. And now it's time for us to build a product.
How much are you thinking about bringing on creators in overlapping or adjacent industries this early on to develop network effects so they can cross-pollinate audiences, cross-promote? Or is that, will that naturally come as a result of kind of your longer-term strategy?
That's something that we really, I think when we went to market, the truth was Beck and I, my co-founder and I, thought it would take 4 months to get 4 people to say yes, and it took 5 weeks. And it was like, whoa, well, I guess people want to do this. And we, all those people are amazing. We're doing great. But what it caused us to happen is like, we had 4 different industries with no overlap, no efficiencies. And over time, what we realized was like, things can be better set up is if we call it a pod strategy. And so marketing was the first one we did, healthcare, then we did that for HR. And now like we launched a sales pod in January with 3 different folks that cover 3 different personas, but kind of there's still opportunity again for like, hey, let's host this event together. Let's do these things. So that's, it definitely is. I think what happens is when it's naive to think when we launch someone from day one, they can sell out an event. Some can, and we've had those personas. Daniel Murray and Nick have proven pretty quickly that they did that. And we've had some new creators, like our HR creator, her second week had 600 people show up to an event, like crazy. But in general, I think it's like naive to count on that. So having a network effect where kind of collectively these people can support each other, fill the room, build that confidence up as a creator, which is so critical to feel like you're getting that like community support and you're doing well. And then over time, that brand starts to grow on its own. And now you can like start to do that on your own. And like, that's kind of the advantage of taking that approach.
for someone of your background who understands the newsletter industry in and out and knows how quickly, I imagine you have tactics such that you can build newsletters and other media properties relatively quickly, especially for creators who, you know, have the makeup for it. Did you give thought to attempting to bootstrap this, understanding that it could take longer to develop? Or were you always of the mind that this was going to be a venture back thing? You wanted to blow it out, do it quickly?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think every person starting a business should ask themselves like what their end outcome wants to be. And I left media and went to TCG because I was like, I am tired of like work. This is an absolutely exhausting industry. It's a, what have you done for me lately? You're constantly advertising and sponsorships is incredibly difficult. It's always like a schmooze game. It's constantly like impressing people. Their marketers have a job just to act like they're unhappy so they get better prices. It's just a really difficult business to have success in. And I think there's a reason why there's never been a $10 billion digitally native media business. It just is really, really hard to do. And only a handful have made it to a billion. And so when thinking about that and the time and commitment needed, I was ready to like get out and just start investing and using media as a strategy to grow businesses was kind of where I wanted to get to. And I just didn't think it was worth the time anymore to build a media business. It just wasn't worth it after the hustle sold. And I kind of had that realization. And when I started meeting Becca for coffee, we're very good friends. We got coffee like once a week, and you know, we started talking and playing around with ideas. And she pitched an idea that we should like focus on build a media business for sales reps. And I was like, how do we make this like not a media business, but like something much bigger? And we created an entire deck and did this whole thing where we're going to create I still think I own all the trademarks and domains and stuff, but we're going to like have a community called Sales Circle. And then we're going to do like a WeWork for salespeople called the Sales Floor and like a recruiting business. And it was like this whole playbook of like, how do we build something much bigger than just media? And like, that's what I was chasing is like, I didn't want to spend all the time, energy, and effort to like have a half X multiple on the business. And I think maturity and wisdom of anybody that's been around is your time is your most valuable asset. And if you can optimize for that to make more with doing the same amount, then you get even more excited and will do more. And, you know, I think the grass always feels greener, but like it was pretty tough in 2021 to like look at the multiples that SaaS companies were getting and platform businesses were getting. And then like looking at Morning Brew and being like, cool, they got 3X. Like, and that was like a win. Industry Dive, like huge win. One of the biggest wins. Axios, like one of the biggest wins of the last two decades, 5X. Very, very tough to like get something higher than that. And that was at the top of the market. And so when we thought about this of like, you know, from day one, it was like, how could we build something much bigger using the skill sets that we do have? And as the idea started to unfold, we had this moment where like, we shouldn't just do this for sales. We should do this for every industry and create a playbook. And I have always been, I've had a sketch of the Disney castle in my office for years. And I just think Walt Disney is like one of the greatest entrepreneurs and Americans basically ever to exist because he inspired creativity and took bets that others wanted. And when thinking about that, of what they did for the entertainment industry, we really just had this shared vision that like we could do this for business and create this like huge brand around great content that people love, that they need, and then build businesses around that. And that's really what drove me back to get back into building.
You mentioned Disney. Although you're somewhat chartering uncharted territory, what are the analogs or other businesses that you've drawn inspiration from or sought direction from?
I think in 1955, Disney made like one of the coolest, boldest bets of all time and saying we're going to build an amusement park out of a production house. And like that boldness is something I think the ethos of Work Week and every person that works here carries with them. Like, just because it hasn't happened, let's question why not. And that's something that I think, you know, we have a lot of memorabilia around the office that shares that. But the other companies that I look up to, I love Industry Dive. I think Sean Griffey is like one of the greatest operators in media to exist. What they did so early on of like creating a house of brand, multiple categories around content that people needed and like no one wanted to support like waste management content, but like it's a massive industry, and mm-hmm. taking these like boring kind of industries and showing that like it can be incredibly valuable is a huge inspiration. Doximity is a publicly traded business now, but they really created a community for doctors, used cult relevance, made them prove who they were. It's free to join, but then they built products within it. I believe, I could be wrong on the stat now, but in the last like 16 years of every startup that went public, I think Airbnb, Uber included, all of them, I think Doximity produces more cash flow than any of them. And it's a community driven business. And I think that's like when we build our membership, that's how I think about that. Constellation Software, another like amazing business that has chosen really boring vertical SaaS kind of products mm-hmm. and just created great, great value. We find inspiration in all three of those. And then I think the last one is like, sounds silly, but like the Turner Novaks of the world, Trungs, the people on Twitter that have had great success and showed that you can have fun and like be silly and be goofy while also being incredibly intelligent. That like those values is something that inspires us all the time.
At least a few of the team members at Workweek are both, 9-to-5 employees and creators, yourself included. What insights have you gained by doing that that you don't think you otherwise would have gained? What advantage has that given you?
What it's given me is empathy. It's so fucking hard. It was Monday of Memorial Day weekend this past weekend, and I had an ad in my newsletter, and I was like, I gotta write. I got to do it. It's the holiday weekend. My daughter was up all night. I'm tired, but like, I have an ad. I got to get this out. I got to get it. I told them, this deadline, I got to do it. And then it's like, well, is this quality? Is it good enough? And that was something that, I managed the editorial team at The Hustle. We had amazing people throughout the years there that like, I didn't do anything really to help them. I gave them the tools and resources potentially, but like they were just talented on their own. And I regret some of the times of how I like viewed that process as more of like a machine as an operator of like, just get this done. And I've said that on Twitter before. I think Sean Puri called me out for that at one point, but creating a podcast, doing a newsletter, I held an event last October as a creator. I held Perpetual Executive Summit. Like you go through this emotional swings of like, is this good enough? Is this too much? Is the price too high? Is this like, how do I do it? And those things help me solve problems for the business. One of like me going through, I'm like, why did we do this? And it's not fair to lean on the creators and force them to always give us that feedback. And so it's nice for me to go through the same process. And then, the other one is like, when we have people that have a death in the family, or, they find out their wife is pregnant, or they just like need a vacation. Having me go through that process allows us to have a little bit of understanding of like, hey, how do we backfill this? And let's test it on me. And we spent a lot of the first like 7 months of like, hey, I have this idea of like how we could scale intimacy this way. Let's try it with me. And some of it worked and some of it didn't. And that's like part of the game, but at least it's on me and not on others. And that's really the point.
And I think when attracting creators, that empathy, the fact that you walk the walk is kind of solidifies that case for why they should join you. You're not just building this business, you're actually one of the creators as well.
I hope so.
What is the biggest challenge or bottleneck for the business over, let's say, the next 12 to 18 months?
It's a crazy time, and I just got a phone with someone I was interviewing for my podcast. I mean, digital media is going to have a tough back half of the year, I think. Salesforce just had a really shitty Q1, which will have a downstream effect, I think, on a lot of SaaS businesses and their marketing spend. We're growing really quickly, and with that comes resource allocation questions and all that. And I think that's the one hat that I have to always view is like, we unfortunately right now, like we can't do everything. Like video is a perfect example. Like we have a lot of creators that would like love to do more and more video. And like, I just can't get there quite yet, but making sure that our creators are successful, that we're hitting, they all have their own personal goals. We have shared goals together, that we're living to our promise and fulfilling the promise that we gave them and making sure they're happy is always the number one important thing. And that always comes with challenges. These are just people. People are amazing and talented and also come with their own challenges. And making sure that we're always prioritizing them is like the number one. The business doesn't exist without them. And so over that is always the number one priority, no matter what the time is, despite whether digital media is tough or any of that. But ultimately, we're just trying to make sure that our creators are incredibly successful and happy. And if we can do that, we think everything else works.
Climbing to 35,000 feet for a few additional questions. What does work week look like in a decade? What will you be doing that you're not doing now?
When I think about that question, I don't really ask myself, like, what do we look like from a product perspective, or what do we look like from a revenue perspective? What I really ask myself is, like, how many lives have we been able to change? I fundamentally believe that, like, if we do what we say we can do, every creator, every knowledge expert that chooses to work with us, we can fundamentally change their lives forever and generationally. And in 10 years, I believe that we should be able to do that for many. And if we can, then like the rest took care of itself. You know, I've said, everyone at Workweek knows this, but the thing we talk about internally, we believe, like, at first we're really a culture business, and we tell every person in the interview process, every person on day one, every launch that I do, anything, that the real goal of the business is, can we get people to work here longer than any other place they've ever worked? And I think if you have long time horizons in media, that's actually how you win. It's one of the weaknesses, I think, of the last 20 years is everyone's been trying to flip a business in 5 years and sell to the next company. And if you not only take long time horizons as a business, but also encourage your team to think on those horizons and encourage them to be here, a lot of magic can happen. And so I think, I hope in 10 years, the amazing people that we're working with today are still with us, that we're still building those brands, and that we've changed a lot of lives in the process.
Why did you feel like this was the right problem and business to commit 7, 10+ years of your life to? And was there a particular moment where you felt that, or was it just kind of this gradual culmination?
Beck and I are like best friends. We hang out all the time. And the real story is that, like, we just were getting coffee and we were definitely brainstorming stuff, but she was like, I just want to work together again. I was like, me too. We had so much fun. And like, we shared the same values, and like, we just represent who we are to each other, and we make ourselves our best selves at work and personal. And when we were doing this, before we had a name, before we had a business model, like before we brainstormed the sales thing, we wrote down a set of values and operating principles. And one of the lessons that we learned is that if we can truly hold yourself together, hold the people you hire and then the workplace that you operate to a set of shared values and a set of shared principles of the way you work, people can actually have fun at work. And it's something that, it's why we say make work fun as like our line, is because if that is actually the outcome of so many inputs that most companies screw up. And if you can have fun at work, why would you ever leave? And I think, like, when I look at the people I admire most, they just enjoyed their days at home and at work. And the financial, the success, I just believe if you get talented people in a room with really long time horizons, like, all that will take care of itself. But Beck and I made those values and operating principles, and they're still the same ones that exist today that we make sure every person memorizes essentially and knows, and we bring them up constantly and we live by them as much as we possibly can. And that gives me the, that was like the, oh man, this is not a 10-year project. Like, this could be my lifelong project. Mm-hmm. If I'm having fun every day, like, it doesn't matter. And that's, you know, you get tested, you get pushed, is like, are we doing this? And of course there's days that are stressful and hard, but ultimately, like, I just want people to, when they go home, be like, man, it's pretty fun. It's pretty wild. And like, then that's retention, but that's success as well.
If you weren't working on this problem, but sticking in the creator space for the next decade, what problem would you be working on? What's other infrastructure or support or tooling that you think is critically missing for creators?
That's a good question. I like to joke that anything part of your work week will one day be part of work week. So all the problems that I would do one day, right, I might do. But on the consumer side, I'll say this. Like, on the consumer side, I think there's still is a lot of, you know, I think Knight Media is doing an amazing job. I think, you know, Endeavor, United Talent Agency with Emma Chamberlain, like there's success stories out there. I still think there's a huge gap in like showing people how to build a media company and not just a personal brand on the consumer side. And there's like very strict steps we take with every creator of how do we build this brand? Who are we making it for? How do we create constraints within that? And that constraints then allows success. And it's just so easy on the consumer side to chase the click of like doing the like thing that actually your audience doesn't really support the long-term growth, the long-term sell-through rate, but it like gives the dopamine hit. And I don't think there's enough infrastructure and support of across the whole ecosystem. As I said, there's examples of as I mentioned, that are people doing this well. Mr. Beast, a perfect example. He's 12 episodes a year. Like he's shown constraint to the highest degree with success. But that constraint is what's, I think, holding back so many people from actually achieving like big success. And I would put a lot of energy and focus there. And then the last one that, you know, maybe one day Workweek solves this, but I think this is a problem across the board. But the 100 true fans, 1,000 true fans, like I think like the shared thought of that is right. Like in general, I think the philosophy of that is still correct. The real issue that I would build if I was somebody is like, how do you create something that really shows what audience is in the intention scale? What audience of yours is actually doing this? An idea that I probably won't build, but someone should, is like, how do you build a clout score? But instead of basing it on like size, I'm not sure if you remember clout from 10 years ago, but it was it was a way that basically influencers got ranked by how big their size was and then how many followers those people had. But like, really, we all know like engagement is the key. So having some tool that shows like true engagement of an audience. And I think what that does is that actually can start to change a lot of lives of people who only have 5,000, 10,000 followers, but like those people are diehards. And those people potentially have multiple million-dollar businesses at their hands if the purchasing power is there and they have no idea. And I think that's like a really fun opportunity that I would go chase.
Sticking with the same decade-long time horizon, how will creators look different in a decade from now, especially with the pace of AI?
I think if you're focusing on curation, you better change. I think in like analysis, expertise, perspective is going to be prioritized. And I also think that the thing we talk about here all the time, and this goes to the point of long form video, but asking yourself how you can make the most of what you have. You know, we have an AI tool that we built in-house that you upload your 16-minute video podcast and it turns it into like 20 clips ranked by virality within like 3 minutes. And it's not anything crazy, but it saved our production time a lot of money. And now it's making those long form podcasts worth investing in because now we have social clips for a week. And starting to think about really the cadence and strategy, and then that's going to identify new skill sets. I think we're in this era right now where long form writing and perspective really shines. And I don't think that's going away ever because that's just a habit. Books have been around forever. It's not going to go away. However, I do think just like any the evolution from 10 years ago to today, 10 years ago, I don't think people were really being like bloggers are the future, but like that's what Substack is. That's what like newsletters are. Right. And I think it's good to think in 10 years, there will be a new format that like someone wins at. And it might be video. It might be something else that then like, and it's because AI probably helped replicate that medium in multiple different ways.
I ask all guests the same closing question, which is, what's one question you'd leave for me and listeners, whether to think about or act on?
Just what gives you the most enjoyment every day? And are you actually spending your time doing that? And if you can answer that question honestly, then I think you'll have the success that you need to find.
I think that's the question and one we spend too little time thinking about. Adam, this was excellent. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it, Spencer.